The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The magic of the cup, cool and calm David Luiz, rock hard granite, an expert finishing from Aubameyang. Who saw that coming as Arsenal outdo City while John Moss runs around in personalised boots? It's Arsenal v Chelsea in the FA Cup final then as David De Gea helps Frank Lampard to another tactically naive victory. Leeds are back in the Premier League after 16 years. We'll ask the big questions. Can Yeboah and Viduka still do it at the top level? And in the Premier League, Nigel Pearson gets the boot. There's injury time agony for Bournemouth, and after writing off Harry Kane on Thursday, we write him back on, and how, as Spurs sweep Leicester aside. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Good morning.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
I'm tremendous. Hello, Paul Doyle.
Hi, Max.
It's nice to see you. Jonathan Wilson, no one cares how you are, but how are you?
The back's really sore, but apart from that, I'm all right, thank you.
here we go. Let's start then with Arsenal 2, Manchester City 0. 21st FA Cup final for Arsenal, more than any other team. Did anybody see this coming, Paul? Did you imagine Arsenal might win this game?
I won't say I saw a victory coming, but I have seen signs of improvement from them in recent weeks. And they have, under Mikel Arteta, have addressed the failings that have been theirs for many years. You know, they're a new, solid and steely and well-organised Arsenal team, so they have a bit of resistance to them. One of the few pleasures of watching football during lockdown is you can hear everything that the, or most of what the players and coaches say, and probably of the matches I've been to, the person who has stood out for that reason most is Arteta. I saw them beat Wolves at Molineux, which was an impressive win, and it was amazing how hands-on his coaching was. He was very much a coach trying to introduce a new method to his team. He was following every move on the sideline and telling them exactly when to start the press, and they were responding and listening to him, and all working very hard in a coordinated way. And it's amazing how when you have a system that suits the players and that they're all willing to buy into, suddenly players who have sort of flopped most amid the chaos and lethargy that was at Arsenal have started to show their qualities much more regularly, like Granit Xhaka and Mustafi, notably, and David Luiz, of course. So I could see that they were improving, but I didn't think they'd beat City. But having said that, City are vulnerable. They've lost a hell of a lot of games this season and through their own frailties.
Jonathan, how impressive is this from Arteta? I mean, it's because it feels like we could tell what the problems were at Arsenal. Is this more an indictment on Emery and Wenger before him, or should we be praising Arteta from the rooftops?
I think we really should be praising Arteta because I think that squad is still pretty shambolic. You know, the three forwards, for instance, and I thought this was really obvious in the North London derby, you have Aubameyang who can play wide but wants to cut inside. Pepe plays on the right but is very left-footed and wants to cut inside. And then Lacazette who's playing inside and not dropping deep. So how anybody thought the three of them, the three most expensive signings, could play together, I've got no idea. Now, you can have that level of depth if you have depth elsewhere in the squad, but they don't. You know, the problems in midfield, the problems at centre-back are well-known. I think the problem with Emery was always communication, and that was obvious in press conferences when you heard things coming out of the dressing room. There was, you know, the really worrying sign of players saying, I don't really know what he wants us to do. So I think whether it's a language issue, whatever, but there was definitely, and I think it's interesting with Emery through his career, his only successes have come in Spain. When he went to Russia, that was a disaster as well. So I think that communication, not in Spanish, was an issue for Emery. And I think late period Wenger, it was really obvious. There was one of those games against Barcelona when they got totally outplayed. And I remember some of people say, oh, yeah, Barcelona hold the ball so much better than Arsenal. And so I think, well, I'm not really sure that's it. I think Arsenal hold the ball just as well as Barcelona. The issue is they don't press, so they don't win it back as well. And Wenger, I think, never really got to grips with the modern notions of pressing. That was his real failure in later years. And Arteta, clearly having sort of learned from Guardiola, is absolutely at the forefront of that.
Barry, I had this theory yesterday that David Luiz stole Virgil van Dijk's magic powers in that Liverpool game, and maybe that's forever. But he was brilliant, Luiz. And when you think about you know, the first game against City after lockdown, where he had a very David Luiz day. It's very impressive of him to pull out a performance like that.
Yeah, but he has become something of a figure of fun this season, and he's always capable of putting in a shockingly bad performance. I do think if he perhaps had a short back and sides rather than a big sideshow Bob Buffon, he wouldn't stand out quite as much when he plays badly or exceptionally well. But David Luiz is a very, very good footballer. He's had a long career at the highest level, and he's won lots and lots of trophies. You know, he was man of the match for Chelsea, playing on one leg when they won the Champions League final in 2012. He's not getting any younger. He has been chaotic at times this season, but on his day, he's a very, very, very good footballer. And my worry, he's not going to play that well every game. Of course he isn't. And Arsenal aren't going to play well as well collectively in every game as they did against Manchester City. But Arsenal fans aren't expecting miracles. They just want crumbs of comfort, something to look forward to. And I think they're certainly getting that from Mikel Arteta.
But I think there's a point with Luis as well about, you know, he's a better player in a back three, and I think that's been true throughout his career. That his instincts, you know, those of a midfielder. Just when he was back at Vitória in Brazil, that's how he started off, and he got moved into a back three there to be sort of an aggressive figure who could pass the ball as well and bring the ball out from a back three. Who could sort of step up into midfield to try and steal the ball. And it's when he's tried to play in a back four that I guess his bad days are most exposed. So that game at City just after lockdown, yeah, he was playing in the back four then. I think the back three, it accentuates the positive parts of his play, and it covers up for the defect.
He also does have a slightly wandering mind, because I think that there is every chance that we'll see him play this well again, because we have seen him play this well many times in the past. But there's also every chance that we'll see him have a comically inept performance again, when his mind just wanders a little and he lapses.
Yeah, Robot of Death says, is there any player with a performance range wider than David Luiz, either brilliant or terrible? Also, like, Granit Xhaka's played really well recently. And I had to check this morning that it was this season that he threw his shirt off and sort of swore at everyone. I think it was the game against Palace when he was subbed off. And you know, to perform that well against quite a good midfield in Manchester City. I mean, we'll get on to how City played in a second, but Xhaka is impressive too.
Well, it does show good strength of character, because I think people thought that was the end of him at Arsenal when he threw the hissy fit at Crystal Palace. And I thought it was kind of understandable. But generally, if you fall out with the fans, it's only going to end up one way, and that's with your exit from the club. And it looked like he was going to go to Stuttgart somewhere, some Bundesliga team. But Arsenal kept him. And while I wouldn't say that performance of David Luiz, while brilliant yesterday, was redemptive, maybe Granit Xhaka's was. I would say Arsenal fans will appreciate A, the performance, and B, the strength of character he's shown, because what happened to him would perhaps have broken more mentally fragile players.
Well, he's perhaps benefited from the games being behind closed doors, that he's able to regain his form and show what he can do without anybody being, you know, so negative towards him and booing him just for that reaction against Palace.
I do think playing behind closed doors probably benefits Arsenal more than a lot of teams, because their fans are incredibly impatient. But I'd say a lot of sides are benefiting from playing closed doors, but few as much as Arsenal.
Granit Xhaka and throwing your shirt off, I mean, that is top of the list of things fans say you just don't do. I mean, they would forgive you murdering someone more than taking off the shirt. It's the shirt. You can't do that. And we should mention Aubameyang. The first finish was great, especially after he'd missed that chance. And the first chance seemed so easy. The one he hit straight at the keeper. We sort of wondered where Man City's defence was at that moment. There's a question from Harpal who says, how has Pep got such an easy ride by the media and pundits? Spent $135 million to win the League Cup, finished 22 points behind Liverpool. If that was Mourinho, we'd be ripping him like we did when he was at United.
Well, he got the Court of Arbitration and Sport decision. That's a trophy.
are we giving him an easy ride, Wilson?
I mean, I think when City have been good this season, they've been still exceptional. You know, they keep beating teams 5-0. They've been exceptional the last two seasons. So, you know, he's got recent credit in the bank that Mourinho, for instance, doesn't have. But equally, you know, I think you do have to start to ask questions when a club has been set up so perfectly for a manager. You know, this enormous glass jaw has been exposed this season, that once you break the press, they're incredibly vulnerable. Balls in behind the back four, they can't deal with. And that's not only been true against, you know, Liverpool or Arsenal or Manchester United. It's also been true against Norwich and Wolves.
Southampton,
yeah. I mean, Wolves obviously are a better side. But yeah, you pop the ball in behind them and they really don't like having those defenders don't like having to turn. We said at the start of the season, if there is a problem with this City side, it's that they haven't replaced Vincent Kompany. There are doubts over the form of Stones and Otamendi. So they probably needed at least one, probably two central defenders to strengthen that area. Is that Pep's fault or is that a recruitment issue? And to what extent does Pep influence recruitment? I think we did highlight that as a potential issue. And they've still got problems at left back, that Mendy, I think, has never quite settled at City, which may be injury related. Zinchenko is sort of filled in there, but it's not a natural position. He's very inexperienced. Cancelo, who's supposed to be able to play on both sides, seems now to be entirely right-sided. And they got away with that last season by playing Laporte there, but he's been so crucial to them in the middle when he hasn't been injured, which has obviously exposed the problems at centre-back. Yeah, the problems are clear, and I guess a test of Guardiola is how he sets about resolving them this summer and next season. And he might still win the Champions League.
Yeah, well, fascinating to see how they do against Real Madrid, aren't they? They're 2-1 up going into that game. Manchester United 1, Chelsea 3. Another one in the eye for you then, Wilson. Super Frank getting another one over Ole. Tactically perfect performance from Lampard's men.
I mean, I thought I'd explain this to you on the radio yesterday.
Okay.
I think what Lampard's done in terms of developing young players, giving them pitch time, what we've done going forward has been very, very good. I think there's been a slightly puzzling rush to praise him, and I think some of the praise has gone overboard. I think there's major questions about their defending of cross-set plays and counter-attacks, which Lampard himself acknowledged on Friday. I think he's unusually thin-skinned for a man in that position, and I think that may become an issue at some point. But yeah, they played really well on Sunday. I've also been very critical of Solskjaer, let's not forget that. I mean, I basically couldn't have won here. There's two managers who I think aren't really up to the jobs they're in playing against each other. But yeah, the switch to a back three from Lampard clearly did help. I thought they pressed really impressively. I thought Willian and Mason Mount, the way they closed down the wide United defenders, you know, was exceptional. I think Willian will be a huge loss if he does leave this summer when his contract expires. And Chelsea have offered him a 2-year extension, but he wants 3. And Chelsea don't normally offer players over the age of 30 more than a 1-year extension. And that was going to be the piece I wrote yesterday until David Ayer started chucking them in, which also helped Chelsea significantly.
What was Barry, was De Gea at fault for the first? I thought he was obviously at fault for the second, but the first, I thought that's quite a difficult thing to say because it's so close in. It's a lovely touch from Giroud. He might have saved it, he might not.
I think he probably should save it, but I would hold him less culpable than Victor Lindelof, who let Giroud get in front of him, despite Giroud sort of clearly signalling his intention to do exactly that from a long way out. And I think Brandon Williams, I would give apportion a sizable chunk of blame as well for not being anywhere near Azpilicueta when he sent the cross in. So De Gea, I think people are eager to pounce on any mistake he makes to highlight his inadequacies. But I would say, yeah, there's certainly a lot of blame to go around for that first goal. He's probably the least culpable of the three players I mentioned.
Well, I think all of that is true. The one thing I would say about that first goal is the thing David De Gea used to be really, really good at is making those blocks with his legs. And if you think of that game at the Emirates in December 2017 when he made the 14 save, and a load of them were reflex blocks with his legs. And it's almost like his shin isn't quite as big as it used to be. That in the old days, there'd have been enough shin there to deflect that away, and here it just sort of slowed the ball down as it went in.
He needs some Robson Gold shin pads that were I had when I was nine. They were bigger than, they sort of came up to my waist.
Oh, I don't know if they still do it, but hockey players used to have like a big polystyrene shin pad they put behind the normal shin pad. So maybe some of them. But I don't know, it just sort of felt indicative of how he's not quite what he used to be, that you could see how he would have saved that 3 years ago, and he didn't save it here.
The good thing for United is they have a ready-made replacement for him for next season, because Dean Henderson has been brilliant for Sheffield United on loan this season. And with the exception of one match where he made a terrible mistake against Liverpool to drop the ball into the net and to give Liverpool victory, but he came back from that really strongly. So he doesn't clearly suffer from the crisis of confidence that seems to be afflicting De Gea at the moment.
Paul, would you bring Henderson in? I mean, would you make that decision?
Yes, I would.
De Gea, do you turn bad overnight? I don't know. He clearly was a very good keeper. He got a lot of grief when he first arrived. He bounced back from that and put in some excellent performances. I remember he was always compared unfavourably to Joe Hart by various high-profile pundits, Gary Neville definitely, and it's interesting to see how they're both faring at the moment. Joe Hart can't get a club, and De Gea is playing the worst football of his career.
But I think they both have a similar technical issue, which is, I think one of the things that really undermined De Gea at the World Cup was that with Spain, he was being asked to play behind a defence that was pushing high, so he was being asked to come out of his box and play in that sort of, the modern sweeper keeper role, which is also something Joe Hart struggled with. And he clearly wasn't comfortable with that. Now, the odd thing is, De Gea's passing is actually really good. I think he's got a 74% pass completion rate, which is higher than Harry Kane's, for instance. He's a good passer of the ball, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you read the game that well, that you're comfortable making the decision when to leave your box, that you can switch the ball quickly from one foot to the other, which was what Guardiola highlighted as the big problem with Joe Hart. So if going forward, Solskjaer wants to play a more sort of progressive form of football, rather than all his, all Solskjaer's really impressive results have come sitting deep, playing on the counter. If he wants to be a more aggressive team that takes the game in the opposition's half more, then he needs a keeper who is comfortable playing behind a higher line. So at some point, he's going to have to make a decision. Is De Gea, even if he starts saving shots again, is he the keeper who can do that? And the evidence of Spain and how that undermined De Gea, apparently undermined De Gea's confidence, suggests perhaps not.
Anyway, both teams have won it six times, Arsenal and Chelsea, in the last 20 years. Finals on the 1st of August, so something for Arsenal-Chelsea fans to look forward to. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we will talk exclusively about Leeds United. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we talk Leeds, Barry and Wilson, we have a live online stream tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Not an official Guardian event, but we'd like all of Earth to come. There are still 7 to 7.5 billion tickets still available, I believe. It's £5. Wilson, any thoughts?
I can't believe it's only a fiver. I'd have charged more. So take advantage of this bargain before I come in to put the prices up.
Perfect. There you are. It's all on our Twitter account. I've scheduled one tweet every hour until the show. So if I've got any followers by the end of tomorrow, thanks for sticking with me. Right. Leeds are in the Premier League. Let's talk to Daniel Chapman from the Square Ball podcast, author of 100 Years of Leeds United, 1919 to 2019. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I think I was running around the car park of the Brudenell Social Club with a billiards trophy from the 1970s at some point last night. So I was glad you pushed this back by an hour. You texted me last night saying, it's going to be 10:30, not 9:30. Yeah, that works.
And like a three-day party, promoted on Friday after West Brom lost at Huddersfield, champions on Saturday after Stoke beat Brentford, and then you win at Derby, and there's obviously a little bit of history with you and Derby, recent history. It almost couldn't be more perfect, could it? Unless you were allowed in the ground, of course.
I think that would have helped, but it has been bewildering. Watching the ball roll in when Huddersfield scored that winner against West Brom was just, it's still surreal. It was one of those rare moments in football where the guy has the ball in the penalty area and you think he is going to score, and then the ball I can still see it just bouncing into the net, and you think, Leeds are up. That was worth 16 years.
And how nervous were you, like, coming back in to restart, and given everything that happened last season and the sort of general narrative of Leeds burning out that we've been trotting out like everyone else has?
It didn't necessarily help when Adam Forshaw went on a podcast and said Leeds were going to romp it and that there was going to be no problems whatsoever, and we came back and immediately lost at Cardiff. We were so good before the break, winning, I think it was 5 games in a row without conceding a goal. And the risk was losing that momentum, and then the Cardiff game was a reality check, and you did worry. But there's a lot more faith in these players this season. I don't think they were going to let last season happen again. That's why they wanted to come back. They were all adamant that they would come back and win this time rather than points per game because of messing up last season. And they did. They keep having team meetings this year. I don't know if that's... It seems a good sign. It's a small thing, but remembering how broken Leeds have been and how terrible so many of the players have been, not just as footballers, but as humans, knowing that this bunch was sort of getting their act together at every kickback, every time they faced a problem, you did have more confidence.
Charlie Phillips is a Leeds fan, wrote in The Guardian, "I wish it hadn't taken 14 years, but if that was the purgatory needed to be rewarded with the 2 years of Bielsa's perfect football, I'll forgive every minute of it." Do you agree with that?
Yes, but reluctantly. It's been too long. This is the worst Leeds United have ever been in their entire history. We've never been in the third division before Ken Bates and Dennis Wise got involved, and never been out the top division for this long. So it's ridiculous that it has been 16 years to get back, 14 years until we got Bielsa. And I can't say I... Does it make the bad times worth it? I mean, Steve Evans as manager. There were some real lows that... If that's what it took to end up with Marcelo Bielsa as manager, then I guess it couldn't have happened any other way, I suppose.
Daniel, people generally, with a few exceptions, but people generally seem really pleased that Leeds are back in the Premier League and are really looking forward to seeing Bielsa manage them in the Premier League, assuming nothing goes horribly wrong during what's left of the summer. How does that make you feel? Because Leeds are, I presume as a Leeds fan, you're used to being hated.
Part of me thinks we should sack Bielsa just so that the Premier League don't get any of him. They haven't earned Marcelo Bielsa gracing their stadiums and their matches, so we should get rid of him, get Steve Evans back, and say, there you go. There's your beautiful Leeds United that you've all been so excited to see. It is strange. We do work better being hated, and I think it's helped. Derby County have actually been a very helpful foil throughout all this. The Spygate stuff last season, I think, was the moment we realised Bielsa was the right manager for Leeds, not just from a football point of view and getting us promoted, but that actually he could get involved with that backs to the wall, everybody hates Leeds stuff. So, I mean, I think we're going to annoy a lot of people. Everybody might be quite glad, you know, oh, it'll be nice to see Bielsa's attacking football in the Premier League, but then they realise that the fans are going to be coming as well. So, yeah, I think that they may get tired of us quite quickly.
Jonathan, I'm not sure if you were aware of Marcelo Bielsa before he came to
Marcelo
Leeds.
Marcelo who?
How surprised are you that he went there, and are you surprised that he's done so well, given how much you've written about him in your endless books that no one's read?
I mean, there's a little bit of me slightly resentful in that, you know, for so years I've been thinking, oh, it'd be great if Sunderland could get him. But just sort of thinking, oh, you know, there's no way he'd come to England. That always wouldn't work. And now you sort of think, well, it could have worked. It would have worked. But the thing that really struck me, and the thing I was actually really moved by, was I went to Scarborough for the county championship game between Yorkshire and Worcestershire. Which was, I think Bielsa had been in charge for 3 games at that point of Leeds. And I remember I got on the train at York to go across to Scarborough. And, you know, Scarborough Festival, it's sort of Yorkshire on fete. Everybody's tweeted up and, you know, it's a celebration of kind of cliched Yorkshireness. every conversation you heard on our train platform that morning was about Leeds and about Bielsa. It wasn't about the cricket. And I'm sure that wouldn't normally be the case. And then I remember I was sort of sat behind this load of, I don't know, 70-year-old blokes who, again, were kind of, you'd expect them to be very suspicious of anybody kind of arriving and turning, yeah, but you know, seeming very sophisticated and very sort of exotic and different. And within three games, they were, you could tell they were completely in love with Bielsa, to the extent that they were asking, I think Leeds were away at Swansea on that night, this is Tuesday night, and you could stream the game. And they were asking me with their kind of, their old Nokias, can I stream game on this phone? No, you can't. You need a smartphone. And then one of them had a smartphone, so I was able to set it up for him. And they'd all sat in the kind of guest house that night and watched the game on his smartphone. So the fact that within three games he'd had that effect, that sort of messianic quality he has. And you've seen it with the celebrations over this weekend, the people going to his house in Wetherby, him greeting the woman in the wheelchair. Football's a world of bluffers, spoofers and hypocrites. And he's none of those things. He's absolutely genuine and just a really good man. And it's great to see him succeed.
And how good is the football, Daniel?
It's incredible. And it was incredible from the start. That when Jonathan's talking about those first three games, the first game against Stoke at Elland Road was just, I couldn't believe it was the same group of players. I think that's one of the incredible things. We got so bad under Paul Heckingbottom at the end of the season before. There was a game away at Norwich, which was Wes Houlihan's last game, and it turned into his testimonial. The players were just standing absolutely stock still while Norwich just passed around and scored easy goals. And then pre-season, you didn't see anything positive, and Bielsa doesn't do many interviews, so there was no press conferences. So nobody had any idea what was really happening. And Calvin Phillips did an interview during those games. He said, I don't really know what I'm supposed to be doing. I think he's trying to play me in defence. And so everybody's really worried about how this is going to turn out. Half-time against Stoke, we're winning, we're looking credible, that we're attacking constantly, the players haven't stopped moving, and they haven't stopped moving for 2 years since. And it has been a joy, and it's been difficult. It's been a shame almost that it's been part of a championship promotion campaign, because it's been very difficult, particularly this season, with so much pressure for Leeds fans, I think, to sit and watch and enjoy the fact that we've had 30 shots in a game and that the other team have touched the ball in our penalty area once. You don't care because the score's only 1-0 and it's taken until the 85th minute to score, and the tension has increased, and it's been very difficult to just enjoy what's actually been happening. Maybe the Premier League, the good thing about the Premier League for Leeds now is that monkey's off our back. We're not anxious and desperate for something that's taken 16 years, so it might be the opportunity to actually enjoy the football that we've been too tense to actually appreciate.
Can I just ask one question? I don't want to sort of introduce a sourner, but what did you think about Kiko Casilla playing on Sunday?
I wouldn't have played him. I didn't want him to play. I think Bielsa has, I don't know if it's because of Spygate or if it's something that's just in him, he seems to have a very strict relationship with the rules in English football. And to him, Kiko Casilla was suspended, so he couldn't play him. And then he was not suspended and he can play him. And he's a better goalkeeper in his mind than the other goalkeepers at the club. And I think Melier probably would have kept his place, but I suspect a young man in drink was not the player we needed in goal, although as it turned out, probably could have done very well against Derby anyway. And so he played him. But he's, I hope we get rid of Kiko Casilla as soon as possible, because there's not been an apology.
Well, I mean, he still maintains his innocence, doesn't he? So I guess that
he does. So
it complicates things.
It's become a difficult situation for the club in that sense, because he just is adamant that he did nothing wrong, and because they employ him, they've got very little recourse apart from he serves his suspension and then is available to play. And then I'm hoping, though, that the recourse they will use will be the transfer market.
Just for the benefit of anyone who may not know, the background to this is obviously that Kiko Casillas was found guilty of racially abusing Charlton Athletic's Jonathan Lecco and served a lengthy ban and got a 60 grand fine, but has not apologised and maintains his innocence. So that, just in case anyone's wondering.
Paul, you were at the game. You were at the Derby game yesterday. You were saying off air what a shame it was that Leeds fans couldn't be there to enjoy that.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because it's amazing that this has been the year where probably the two most epic and poignant quests in English football have reached their climax, you know, Liverpool winning the league and Leeds returning to the Premier League, and there's been no fans there to behold it, because it would have been just a brilliant party, because Leeds fans, although they have this reputation, I think Premier League fans will welcome Leeds fans coming to the ground, because they just make it such a brilliant event. They travel in huge numbers and they're very funny. There's lots of very funny songs and they're also funny in terms of their hair trigger hostility. It's amazing. You've never seen people anger as quickly as Leeds fans when a throw-in is given against them or something. It's brilliant. I like it.
Danny, is there an extra poignancy for it to happen this year after losing Trevor Cherry, Norman Hunter, and most recently Jack Charlton?
Yeah, definitely. I was lucky to be... I watch games on the gantry at Elland Road, and Norman Hunter did watch every game up there over the last two seasons and years before I started sitting up there. And he used to kind of sit on his own at the end, and just, I think he wanted to kind of be on his own and concentrate on the game and not be bothered by anybody around him. So he always had a bit of space. But then when the game got going, he couldn't resist turning to the nearest person and start lambasting the defending or slagging off the referee and shouting just like a fan. He needed somebody to bounce off, and quite often I'd be the person who was kind of receiving a lot of that, you know, Norman Hunter telling me that they're not defending well enough, and I'd be kind of, I think you're probably right. I'm not going to dispute that. And the last game against Huddersfield, as he walked behind us and he was saying that it looks like we've got it, and was very happy about that. And it's not just those three. One of the downsides of it being 16 years is, I mean, Gary Speed was alive when we were last in the Premier League, and Bobby Collins and Bill Fotherby, who was the managing director when we won the league in 92, and so many fans as well. There was a contributor for the Square Ball called John Cave, who used to write stuff about the 1950s and hated what we'd become under Ken Bates, and would absolutely have loved seeing Marcelo Bielsa and seeing us back in the Premier League. And so when we talk about 16 years and kind of how long it's taken, that becomes a factor as well, that it's not just the recent losses, it's that an awful lot has happened in that time. People have grown up and left school. We're 16-year-olds who have, you know, had an entire life and not seen Leeds United kick a ball in the Premier League. It's a crazy amount of time.
Yeah, there was a really nice photo, wasn't there, of a dad, a brother and a sister, I think, with the "We'll Be Back" photo, and they'd recreated it, and the boy and the girl have grown up and the dad's older, and it was a lovely picture. A bit of news today about one of your coaches, Carlos Corberan, approached to take over at Huddersfield. I mean, I don't know how much you know that he does for Leeds or how important he is to this whole thing, but I don't know your thoughts on that.
He was the under-23s coach. He was there before Bielsa, and they've done very well. The under-23s do replicate the first team. He does seem to want to be a coach. Some fans have wondered if he would take over from Bielsa. We've got that worry of what happens after Bielsa has gone, who takes over. And so we thought maybe if we train up the under-23s guy, that's a way forward. But yesterday was quite bewildering because, you know, you keep getting this news through that Huddersfield have got rid of the Cowley twins, and then Pearson's left Watford, and you're thinking, why does anybody care? Leeds have been promoted. Don't bother us with these trivialities. I don't even know. There were other games played yesterday, weren't there? And I have absolutely no idea what happened in any of them.
How do you think Leeds will do in the Premier League? Because one of the interesting things about them is Bielsa has brought brilliant performances, mostly from players who were already there and hadn't shown, people like Click, who wasn't even getting in your team. But some of the guys that have come in since him have kind of split opinion. Obviously, Kiko, the keeper, and Patrick Bamford. Where do you stand on the Bamford question?
I wish he'd score more goals. That would really help. I was quite angry about Patrick Bamford at the start of the season because we needed to get promoted and we needed a striker who would score goals. And Kemar Roofe had gone to Anderlecht, and who are we going to bring in? As the season's gone on, and as the team in general have won the championship, the anger subsided and the fact he wasn't doing it. You just had to accept, okay, Pat Bamford is our striker. He's not going to score a huge amount of goals, but he does everything that Bielsa wants and is a nice guy. And I think the team as a whole, players like Click and Dallas and Ayling and Cooper and Berardi, who they're all 28, 29, 30 going into the Premier League. I don't want any of them to be replaced. I would like Pat Bamford to be our striker in the Premier League and start scoring 25 goals and just see if he's got it in them, because they've got involved in Bielsa's ideas to an extent that I'm not sure a group of players who maybe, if he'd taken over a lower Premier League club full of 21-year-olds who think they're going to live forever, whether he would have had the same impact as he's had on a group of 28-year-olds who this is basically their last chance to get medals, this is their last chance to get in the Premier League, their last chance to get the big wages, and so have happily sacrificed their health and happiness and free time to do everything that's been asked of them by him. And I think their reward now is to go into the Premier League and try and do it there. And so we'll need another striker because we've got one. Bielsa's small squad is a constant bone of contention in Leeds. So we do need another striker. But if Pat Bamford can find 25 goals in him, I won't care. I'll be delighted.
Daniel, I know you don't know, but there were other games that other people might be interested in. So we will talk about them in a sec. Thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it and congratulations.
Thank you very much. See you next season.
Daniel Chapman there from the Square Ball podcast. There's so much to play for in the Championship. West Brom, Fulham and Brentford can all still get automatic promotion. There's an interesting scenario that West Brom play QPR, and West Brom have a player called Darnell Furlong. And if he goes up, then QPR get more money from him going up and getting a bonus from that. And if QPR win, then one of their rivals, Brentford or Fulham, will go up, probably. So Huss is a Fulham fan thinking, what are the chances of QPR really going for this game? Obviously, they're all professionals and they'll give it their best shot. At the bottom, Hull are gone, barring something extraordinary. Barnsley and Luton are in the relegation zone, but Middlesbrough, Birmingham and Charlton are still not totally safe. And Richard Jolly's tweet of the pod, Brentford's last top flight game, it was in their hands until they lost to Stoke, was the last game they played before Roy Hodgson was born. So there you are. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we will round up the Premier League action over the weekend. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. On Friday, West Ham beat Watford 3-1. On Sunday, Watford sacked Nigel Pearson. Peter asks, are we becoming a piece of surrealist performance art? Ryan says, I'm currently the only sports reporter working at the Watford Observer. Are there any quieter jobs going on the pod? Padraig says, how close are Watford to introducing a winner stays on policy to their managers? And Craig says, in an Observer interview before the season started, it finished with me and you, Barry, joking about not talking about Watford all season long. Can I request that is invoked for the next two games, please? Much appreciated. Watford becoming the first Premier League club to sack three managers in a season. Pearson had the best win rate, 35%, and points per game ratio, 1.25, of any Watford manager in Premier League history. Barry, why is he gone?
Well, I wouldn't say he's done a brilliant job, but he's done a decent job. They were 6 points adrift, or away from safety when he took over, and they're 3 points clear of the drop at the moment. They may well go down, though, the two very tough games coming up. According to a newspaper report in the Daily Mail, who broke the story, Pearson had a frank exchange of views with Mr. Pozzo, his boss at Watford, the Watford owner, and that was the end of that. They apparently asked Pearson's number two, Craig Shakespeare, to stay on, but he was loyal to Pearson and went with him. So now it's Hayden Mullins, I think, who will oversee their last two games. But it just seems to have been a clash of personalities. I must say, I was shocked when I heard the news, but Watford sacking managers abruptly shouldn't really be shocking news.
Simon Burton, who's a Watford fan, said if Watford survive, it'll be down to the abysmal form of Villa and Bournemouth as much as the efforts of Pearson and their own players. Having swiftly established his favoured 4-2-3-1 formation, nothing could convince him to vary it. It seemed impossible for some players to lose their places in the starting 11, no matter how poor their form or even their fitness. Fair points, Paul?
Yes, I think it is. When guys are being paid as much as these managers are, I'm all in favour of their employers being ruthless. When people are being paid what the Guardian pay me, I'm less keen on ruthlessness. I just like to make that point that in. But yeah, so they've obviously decided we've got two matches left, and we're not going to win them the way we're playing at the moment, because Watford have been bad in the last few games, as much as Pearson had a very good impact in his first few matches. And so they've decided to get someone who'll try and inspire just for even one game, because one win will probably be enough. Maybe even 1 point will probably be enough. Maybe two defeats will suffice, given the people below. So they've had a shot at it, and that's okay, because the way that Watford played last week against West Ham, nothing suggested that they were going to get anything from City.
I was just upset they didn't give it to Troy Deeney till the end of the season. So Deeney and Foster would have been my managerial dream team.
Watford's last game of the season is against Arsenal, just as Arsenal have grown a pair of cojones.
That's a very good point. Nigel Pearson tweeting this morning, I've been overwhelmed by the well wishes I've received from Watford supporters and the football community. Thank you for all your kind messages. Although not able to finish the task I was brought in to achieve, I wish Watford all the best for their final two games. Cheers, Nigel. So that's nice, isn't it? He's, you know, he's very sort of gallant and respectful response. So we should mention that West Ham game. Mike says, who had Mikel Antonio as the COVID Ronaldo on their bingo card? He's been quite brilliant, Antonio, hasn't he? And Mark Noble, whose legs went, as far as I can tell, about 25 years ago, it's what people seem to suggest, has now played 500 games for West Ham, which is an extraordinary achievement, Wilson.
Yes, it is. I mean, especially given how West Ham buy and sell players. And you're quite an achievement to hit that exact pitch of slightly better than mediocrity, to not be bought by anybody, but also not be sold. But no, he's...
That's the praise we were looking for.
I was going to suggest that 500 appearances for West Ham just smacks to me of a complete waste of time.
I don't know. There's something good about, you know, one club men who epitomise.
But you know how, like, the defining feature of a noble gas is that it's inert.
I mean, I always thought he deserved maybe a couple of England caps. And there was even talk of him getting an Ireland call up at one point, and I think we'd have been delighted to have him. But he seems like an absolute top bloke. And it is, of course, a great achievement, just that kind of longevity. And he's still a good player, although he does occasionally get the runaround there from younger, fitter boys.
I know how he feels. Bournemouth 0, Southampton 2. Injury time sickener for Bournemouth. From 1-0 up to 1-1 to 2-0 down in the space of sort of 4 minutes. I mean, I don't understand goal music with fans in the stadium. Without it, it's terrible. When you play Gala's Freed from Desire and then the goal is chalked off for a dodgy offside, it sort of says it all. Is that it for Bournemouth, Baz?
I think so. I mean, it's not inconceivable that they could beat Everton next week. I could see, you know, Everton are Everton. Bournemouth played reasonably well for the first half yesterday, but they need other results to go their way, and those results could conceivably go their way. But I wonder, would Bournemouth just be better off getting relegated, to be honest? Their fans would probably disagree, but they're clinging on like a pubic hair on a shower tile, aren't they, to borrow a gag from Jerry Seinfeld. I'm not so sure that relegation would be a terrible thing for them, just to give them a chance maybe to reboot. And
they might end up doing a Huddersfield and sort of, or a Sunderland, and just sort of keeping on plummeting. And once you get in that habit of losing, it's quite hard to break.
You're saying Sunderland just went straight down the plug hole as quickly as they possibly could.
Yeah, quite.
Paul, how good is Danny Ings? Like, genuinely, how good is he? Because he's like, his goal scoring this season has been sensational.
Yeah, he's very good. Everyone can see he's an excellent finisher. His movement is very smart. The reason it didn't work out for him at Liverpool was injuries. So he's really good. He might be Harry Kane's main competitor for the number nine start with England, isn't he?
You mentioned Harry Kane. He scored two. Spurs beat Leicester 3-0. We wrote off Harry Kane on Thursday. Well, Johnny Lou did, but I certainly helped him over the line. He was brilliant yesterday. And I actually thought the first time I've seen him since lockdown and since he was back from injury, he looked like the Harry Kane that I sort of remember, doing everything well, Wilson, holding it up, but also finishing, getting around the pitch quickly, showing strength as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's Kane's sort of great ability, isn't it? That he just sort of does everything 8, 8.5 out of 10. You know, he's not a brilliant dribbler. He's not particularly quick. He's not particularly big, but he is just a complete player. And he combines that with a clearly profound understanding of the game and an instinct for scoring goals. And I still sort of remember when he hit that first purple patch. And there was that game, was it on New Year's Day? It was definitely around Christmas. I definitely had a hangover when Tottenham beat Chelsea 5-3. And that was the first game when I sort of thought, actually, maybe this isn't just one of those freakish runs where somebody scores loads of goals for no reason. Maybe he actually is a really good player. But there's still this sort of sense of, I'm not quite sure what it is that makes him exceptional. But he clearly is exceptional. Although with these, he's a slow starter after a break, whether that's an injury or whether that's after a summer or a lockdown.
I thought, Barry, and I don't want to do a full about turn on one performance against Leicester, who seem to just doing their own thing at the moment, but I sort of saw a plan from Mourinho that I didn't hate yesterday.
Well, that's a ringing endorsement. I was trying to think about what to say about Spurs today without sounding like a total hypocrite. I was impressed with them. I think it's worth putting in the caveat that Leicester have been pretty diabolical. They were missing both their fullbacks in Kyler Soyuncu, who obviously was suspended, although he hasn't been particularly good in recent games. So Wes Morgan got a rare start. I don't know how I would feel if I was a Tottenham fan. I can't see them achieving much under Jose Mourinho. I'm not sure what Tottenham fans particularly want. Is Champions League qualification next season enough for them? Do they just want to win anything, a League Cup? Would that do? But trying to put my personal dislike of Jose to one side, I'm not so sure if I was a Tottenham fan, I've seen enough to make me want him to stay on. But obviously he will, because they're doing quite well.
Games tonight, Brighton, Newcastle, Sheffield United, Everton and Wolves Palace. A couple of quick things to finish with. Peter says, will Barry and Wilson be watching Sunderland Phoenix Club in the Wearside Combination League when Stuart Donald finishes his destroy and exit job?
Well, he has exited now. He resigned as chairman yesterday.
He's resigned as chairman. Earlier this week, he told BBC Radio Newcastle his asking price was £37.6 million. He was encouraging fans to buy the club. He holds a 74% stake. He said, the buck for starting a third successive season in League One stops with me. To give the club the best chance of achieving its goals, I have made the judgment that it's right for me to step back from the chairmanship. My intention remains to sell Sunderland to a suitable new owner, and I remain personally committed to that goal. Wilson?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that when he and Charlie Methven came in, they said they were putting 40 million. Yeah, they were spending 40 million. It turns out they spent roughly 10 million and the rest was leveraged. So when you have somebody who has allowed a misunderstanding to become commonly understood, you question every statement they make. Every single decision they've made to do with fans during lockdown has been catastrophically badly handled. You know, the idea of, oh, you know, no refunds, or refunds now delayed. And yeah, they keep on having to go back on them because everybody sort of howls in outrage. You know, I've got mates who got their first season ticket when I did, you know, 30 odd years ago, who have stopped the direct debit. And they're talking about, oh, we'll just go and watch it on a hooky feed in a pub in Shields. You know, that level of disillusionment, it's not particularly to do with what's on the pitch. It's to do with the sense of, I just don't want to give money to somebody I don't like or trust. You know, those 30,000 crowds that Sunderland are getting, it's the one thing they've still got going for them. And even 30,000 in that stadium feels empty. If you have 48,000 capacity stadium, if that drops to 25 or 20 or 15, and it could, you know, where do you go from there? The thing is a disaster.
You wanted to talk about Silvio Marzolini.
Yeah, who died last week. Played against Jack Charlton in that 66 World Cup quarterfinal. The greatest Argentinian left-back of all time. I think if you look at the development of the fullback position, that's obviously something we've become very aware of recently. They've become increasingly attacking. I think that, you know, you sort of see two phases of that process. So it happens, you know, from the 90s onwards, it's been happening. But the first shift was in the 60s. And the three who really pioneered that were Nilton Santos of Brazil, Jacinto Facchetti of Italy, and Silvio Marcellini of Argentina. I think he was left back in the play of the tournament in the 66 World Cup. I think he won five championships with Boca, managed them twice, managed Maradona twice at Boca. And just a lovely, lovely man. And also sort of the first big pin-up of Argentinian football. So I went to interview him for my book. One of the people I had helped him with translation, her grandmother was so excited to hear that her granddaughter was going to be meeting Silvio Marcellini. She insisted on getting a signed photo of him, even though by this point he was, I guess, 80. And he, you know, he gave me this postcard he had made when he was advertising espadrilles in the 60s. And he appeared in films. So he was a massive for the heartthrob. And he looked a little bit like Robert Redford. And obviously being blonde in Argentina, you stand out even more. And so I interviewed him. And his memory was starting to fade slightly, but he couldn't quite remember details. But then the next day I interviewed Antonio Ratin, who was Argentina's captain, and his captain at Boca as well. You know, I don't know how he even found out about it, but he mostly turned up for that interview as well. Basically just sit there and listen and then take the piss out of Ratin. So there's a story told, which Ratin kept trying to deny, then eventually had to admit it was true. That in 66, Argentina's organisation was a complete shambles. And they tried to arrange, they're based, I guess, in Birmingham, somewhere around the Midlands, but they'd arranged a training session at Bisham Abbey. And the bus gets lost on the way, they arrive late. Everybody's sort of really annoyed at this kind of, you know, this terrible disorganisation. And it then turns out the kit man's left half the kit back in the hotel. So they just go to lost property at Bisham Abbey and like grab what they can. And Ratin, who's a, you know, a really big, strapping bloke, ends up wearing this tiny little green and white vest. And so Marcellini literally spends like sort of 10 minutes just taking the piss out of Ratin for this green and white vest that he just had to wear in this training session. So he was, yeah, he's a lovely man. And I know he'd been struggling with his health recently and had a stroke and died last week. So huge sympathy to his family and to his friends. And one of Argentina's greatest ever players, who I think perhaps we don't know that much about over here.
Thanks, Wilson. And that'll do for today's pod. Paul, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
See you at the live show tomorrow. Thank you, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
I'll see you tomorrow morning and tomorrow evening. Tomorrow, Lars, Sid and Nikki join us for a Europod special.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.